This is the Morning Magazine for April 25th, 2022. I'm your host, Jack Armstrong. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act is set to expire this summer. We'll hear from those impacted by radiation exposure about the implications. The 50th annual Rainbow Gathering is coming to Colorado, and some communities are apprehensive. And we'll take a look at what's coming up on this afternoon's Metro Show. At the bottom of the hour, we'll hear the BBC headlines and then the Hightower Lowdown, followed by a public affair. Today, we'll hear a conversation between news director Shannon Young and Boulder Mayor Aaron Brockett. Then, at 9 a.m., we'll bring you Counterspin, a look at fairness and accuracy in reporting. After that, Leland Rucker will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. All that is still all this morning, but first, these headlines with KGN News' Ellie Stuckrath.
A climate activist from Boulder has died after setting himself on fire Friday evening outside of the U.S. Supreme Court building. 50-year-old Bruce Nguyen died from his injuries Saturday morning. Bruce was a Buddhist climate activist linked to Boulder's Shambhala Center. At least one of Bruce's friends has suggested his death not so much a suicide as it was a self-immolation to call attention to political inaction on climate change. Bruce timed his death to occur on Earth Day. He left a cryptic comment referring to a fire on April 22nd of 2022 on his Facebook page, but no known message to clarify his reasons for setting himself on fire. Arapaho and Roosevelt National Forests have enacted Stage 1 fire restrictions in Clear Creek, Boulder, and Canyon Lakes Ranger Districts. In a Friday afternoon press release, the Forest Service cited continued drying and warm weather conditions, as well as recent wildfires, as the cause behind the restrictions. Stage 1 fire restrictions disallows fire outside of metal or concrete fire pits, smoking, using explosives, and more. Violation of these restrictions could result in a fine of $5,000 for an individual or $10,000 for an organization and even imprisonment. Boulder County Sheriff Joe Paley instated similar restrictions late last week. Rent stabilization was removed from House Bill 1287, otherwise known as the Mobile Home Parks Bill, after Governor Polis threatened to veto the bill. KGNU's Jada Rodriguez has more.
Rent stabilization was removed from House Bill 1287, otherwise known as Mobile Home Parks Bill, after Governor Polis threatened to veto the bill. Sponsors of the bill said that Polis threatened to veto the bill if creators did not remove language that limited rent control. Sponsors say language to prohibit a landlord from increasing mobile home rent 3 percentage points or a number that exceeds inflation rates was at the heart of the bill. Critics worried that it could be the first step towards statewide rent control. For KGNU, this is Jada Rodriguez.
The Colorado House of Representatives has advanced a bill that would create harsher penalties for the possession and distribution of fentanyl. KGNU's Ariana Proctor has more.
House Bill 1326 would increase the criminal penalties for possessing more than 1 gram of fentanyl, up from a misdemeanor for 4 grams. Fentanyl is a powerful synthetic opioid linked to record-high increases in fatal overdoses. Opposition to the bill has mostly come from lawmakers who have raised concerns about using incarceration to address a public health problem.
Governor Jared Polis and Attorney General Phil Weiser favored a zero-tolerance stance because of fentanyl strength and presence in other controlled substances. Anecdotal evidence indicates many fatal overdoses involving fentanyl came as the result of drug supply contamination. Critics of HB 1326, including Representatives Leslie Herod, Jennifer Bacon, and Mike Wiesman, say it could lead to increased felony drug prosecutions, including for people unknowingly in possession. Harm reduction advocates say the harsher penalties would also criminalize people with drug dependencies while doing nothing to address the root issue. The bill is now awaiting a final vote in the House. For KGNU, I'm Ariana Proctor.
A Starbucks location in Superior has become the first in Colorado to successfully unionize. Workers at the Starbucks off Colton and Rock Creek Parkway received the news Friday afternoon. The unionization effort at Starbucks locations nationwide has gathered momentum rapidly over the past few months, with workers around 30 locations having voted to unionize. Workers at another 5 Starbucks locations in Colorado are in the midst of organizing for union representation. A water main break flooded 8 blocks in northwest Denver on Saturday morning, partially submerging cars and approaching front doors. Denver Water's spokesperson, Travis Thompson, told the Denver Post it took several hours to stop the flood because they had to shut off dozens of valves in the area. The water receded Sunday afternoon, but 2 blocks remained without water service. No boil advisories were put in place in the area. Denver Water also sent crews to speak with local residents about damages and to pump water out of homes. Residents can file claims directly with Denver Water or work with their homeowner's insurance. The National Weather forecasts it to be mostly sunny with a high of 55 degrees today. Sunny conditions are expected from 8 to 11 a.m., and mostly cloudy conditions are expected to start around 3 p.m. Tonight will be in the mid-30s with a low cloud cover. Tomorrow is looking to be a little more warm, with a high of 74 degrees and partial sunshine. Outside the Boulder studio, it is currently 36 degrees. For KGNU, I'm Ellie Stuckrath.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm Jack Armstrong. The Radiation Exposure Compensation Act is set to expire on July 10th, and it was first passed in 1990 to provide benefits to those impacted by nuclear weapons industry. Those included uranium mine workers and those downwind of atomic testing. But many people alive today still qualify for benefits, but haven't collected. A new bill expanding coverage is in Congress. Proponents are in a race to pass it. Rocky Mountain Community Radio's Justin Higginbottom speaks to those impacted by radiation exposure about the support they're hoping for.
Those sounds are trucks hauling material from the Moab Uranium Mill Tailings Remedial Action Project. The U.S. Department of Energy is cleaning up around 16 million tons of uranium tailings here on the banks of the Colorado River, waste from the Atlas Uranium Ore Processing Facility. Uranium created a lot of wealth in the region and helped the country build its nuclear arsenal during the Cold War, but it came at a price, like those tailings which are radioactive. And it's not only the landscape that was left scarred.
My father was a former underground uranium miner, died at the age of 44 years old from lung cancer. And I also worked in the mine while I was in high school down in Colorado.
That's Phil Harrison Jr. He heads the Navajo Uranium Radiation Victims Committee. It's been around since the late 70s. Many uranium mines and mills were on the Navajo Nation or used Navajo workers, like Harrison's father. Harrison says that out of 5 siblings...
I think it's only myself, my brother, and my sister that knew my dad. The last 3, they didn't know their father. And so typical of all the former Navajo uranium workers.
He says he's recorded over 400 other former workers in his community in Northeast Arizona who have died of lung disease.
So we have like over 400 widows, and we have children that didn't know their father, they didn't know their grandfather. So it's very discouraging, you know, when you go out to my community, there's hardly anyone around these days.
Harrison has been involved in pushing legislation to help those impacted by the nuclear industry for decades. He says he helped draft the amended Radiation Exposure Compensation Act over 20 years ago. That amendment included expanded help for downwinders, those that were exposed to fallout from nuclear testing. Mary Dixon thinks that's her.
It started because I was diagnosed with thyroid cancer, which is one of the cancers that's pretty common from radiation exposure. I was only 29 when I got that.
Doctors removed her thyroid, and then the treatment was more radiation.
You drank radioactive iodine to destroy any remaining thyroid tissue. So I had on my hospital bracelet a little emblem that said, caution, radioactive material.
A doctor would come to her door and hold up a Geiger counter every day until she was not too hot. When she left the hospital, she was told to avoid pregnant women or share a bed with her husband for a time.
Nothing makes you an activist faster than a diagnosis, I always say.
Thyroid cancer is especially common for downwinders. Ann Dixon says the fallout from detonation spread much further than originally thought.
If you were driving from Los Angeles to Salt Lake City on U.S. Highway 91, you'd pass through St. George, Utah, population 4,562, just a short way from the state line of Nevada.
That's footage from the United States Atomic Energy Commission. The government detonated nearly 1,000 atomic bombs at the Nevada test site. A 1997 study by the National Cancer Institute says that nearly every state experienced some fallout from that testing. It estimates the detonations caused tens of thousands of cases of thyroid cancer around the country.
Since the rest of the town was sound asleep, only our night owl saw it, that great flash in the western sky. An atomic bomb at the Nevada test site 140 miles to the west.
Dixon has also been working on expanding RECA for around 30 years. She was never eligible for benefits because her northern Utah county wasn't covered.
That Cold War had casualties and still has casualties. People are still getting sick.
Another issue she wants fixed, RECA only covers those working in mines and mills before 1972. Linda Evers can't receive benefits because she started working in a uranium mill in 76.
I started on the labor gang in the mill, which was 90 days of do whatever they needed done, stuff like shoveling chutes out or scraping the acid tanks out or cleaning the yellow cake filters. We just worked everywhere.
She was only 18 when she started. She says she then worked in what was called the crusher. That was part of the process to start leaching yellow cake from the ore.
Well, I guess it was 4.5 years. And got pregnant with my first child that was born in 79 with birth defects that had to be repaired by the time he was 2 months old.
She went back to work for a different company, but it was similar.
And then was off to have my second child in 82 that was also born with birth defects.
She didn't link the birth defects to the mill at the time.
We weren't told at all at any time how radiated we were getting. I had worked out there a couple of years before I ever saw a radon monitoring tag get put in my hard hat.
She says those tags, which detect how much radiation workers were exposed to, were only collected once in the years she worked there. She thinks the owners and regulators knew what the risks to workers' health were.
The problem is the protective gear is so expensive, and you're running massive amounts of workers through. You can't give every one of them a radiation suit, because what if he only pans out for a couple of weeks? You wasted all that money.
She thinks the radiation that harmed her children also gave her breast cancer and a degenerative bone disease. She helped found the Post-71 Uranium Workers Committee and headed around the country to survey workers like herself. She collected data from Monticello to Tennessee, but she felt ignored by Washington. She says the expanded RECA in Congress now is crucial. It would extend benefits for another 19 years, and it would include post-71 workers like herself.
Well, it allows us to get the medical care that we need. Your regular family primary health care doesn't really know how to treat lungs that are scarred from radiation damage.
She has to travel to Albuquerque for specialty care. Her Medicare doesn't cover the expenses.
We were told every day we were doing our part to keep America safe. We were told every day. So these people are patriotic, very, very patriotic people that we feel like we've already given our lives for this country.
Harrison on the Navajo Nation is trying to file as many claims as possible in the next 2 months before the act expires. He says it takes time to get the tests and documents required. Recently, he was helping one former miner who had lung disease. He says in rural and remote parts of the reservation, it's hard to get something as basic as a diagnosis letter.
After 4 months, I finally got that diagnosis letter. So I was able to help him put a claim together. I sent it in. He received a notice a week after he died that, you know, his claim was approved.
He says the pandemic hit those on the Navajo Nation with respiratory illnesses especially hard. He lost many former workers that could have received benefits.
I feel that the government has done a lot of damage, and it took away a lot of our fathers, and my fathers had never seen what the Western world has, when they say the American dream, and they never knew what American dream was. They never reached their adult life.
Harrison says he's heading to Washington within the month to plead his people's case to lawmakers. Until then, he can only start the claims process for others, even those he knows he can't finish in time. Justin Higginbottom for Rocky Mountain Community Radio.
Celebrating its 50th anniversary this year, the Rainbow Gathering of the Tribes is set to potentially bring thousands of campers to Colorado this summer for their annual week-long celebration. But not everybody is excited about this massive festival of camping hippies. The Colorado Sun described the Rainbow Gathering as a national bacchanal, and locals are concerned about potential wildfires, illegal activity, and trash coming along with thousands of attendees. When this news dropped a couple weeks ago, backlash was swift and vocal, with Reddit posts of how to fight back against the event garnering more than 600 comments in less than 24 hours. But missing from this discourse were voices of those who have actually been to the Rainbow Gatherings. So, CityCast Denver host Bree Davies found one.
Tenali Rennick, welcome to CityCast Denver.
It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
The reason I wanted to talk to you was here in Colorado, there was sort of some hubbub when folks learned that the annual Rainbow Gathering may be coming back to Colorado for its 50th anniversary. And folks were worried about thousands of people coming and potentially trampling on our precious outdoors. But I want to hear from you, a firsthand experience person. What are people getting wrong about Rainbow Gathering?
Well, first, like, they started in 1972. And since, it's become a global phenomenon because they happen all around the world now in many countries. And I've been to several gatherings outside the U.S. And one thing I've noticed is the U.S. is always the least welcoming. There's always a little bit of hysteria. But for me, I think the fear that people have is natural, but I think something that gets exaggerated is how many people are going to attend. I just saw an article yesterday that there was a claim that 80,000 were attending. And you know what? I believe the first gathering in 1972, by all accounts, was roughly 20,000. And I believe the biggest gathering that I've ever attended was probably 1997 in Oregon. That probably was 25,000. But it's always hard to say because it's just a guesstimate. Like, we've never even had 40,000, 50,000, much less 80,000. So I think those are exaggerated. And I think that puts people on edge because they're like, 80,000 people. And nowadays, I mean, I'd be surprised with Colorado if we get 10,000. But I could be wrong. I don't know. Maybe more will show.
Sure, sure. And I mean, I get the fear in that, like, you know, if we say like a traditional music festival, it's a ticketed event, there's some sort of infrastructure around it. Thinking about 20,000 people showing up into a space can be a little bit daunting. So, but do you think that these concerns about trash and crime, and particularly Colorado, we deal with wildfires and it's been pretty detrimental. Are those founded concerns?
If there wasn't the cleanup effort and the dedication involved, Rainbow Gatherings would not have existed for as long as they have. I mean, you wouldn't have 50 years if you just trashed a place. I personally have seen well over a dozen previous annual sites, sites that have had 10, 20,000 people at them. And you can't see the impact. Like, I've gone and tried to see, like, finding the old slit latrines or an old compost pit. And it's very hard. Like, you'd have to really know what you're looking for. And even then, it's very difficult because you can see a slight depression in the earth or something. But it's the cleanup effort that is involved with Rainbow that, you know, several dozens of people stay for weeks after cleaning up and sorting through the recycling and dispersing trails. We usually work with the Forest Service during the cleanup process, like how, you know, we dismantle all the bridges, all the kitchen stuff. And I mean, it looks really, really good. And as someone who's an avid hiker and camper, I mean, I've been in national forests. I've seen the box spring mattresses and the beer cans. You know, there's trash in the forest. And sometimes we go to a gathering site and we're cleaning up trash. It's there, and it's a responsibility of all of us that go camping, whether it's a Rainbow Gathering or not, to clean up after yourself.
It would be like if you went to a music festival as a patron, but you also were part of a cleanup crew, mm-hmm. and also maybe you were a performer. Like, there was more fluidity around the roles that people have within these gatherings.
Yeah, like for me, the Rainbow Gathering is not a vacation. I go there and people are hiking miles a day. They're carrying in sacks of rice for 2 miles. you're digging a compost pit and you're putting up tarps and there just the day-to-day activity, it is absolutely not a vacation for me. Maybe some people might treat it as such, but even if you barely lift a finger, you're still hiking. You're still carrying your own stuff in or whatever. So it is very much more a sense of like a pilgrimage. As a friend once described it, it's like boot camp for the soul. And I think that's a very apt description because there are, for me, many lessons that can be learned at a rainbow gathering. And there's been many takeaways. Each gathering, I learned something new. And it helps refine my sense of like being patient, listening to one another, adding more care and compassion in my life. And so all of these like magical like performances that I would hear on the campfire led me to want to start field recording at Rainbow Gathering. So I started doing that in 2000 and I've been doing it ever since. So over 20 years, I've amassed an archive of nearly 1500 recordings mixed of like ambient nature sounds, campfire music, poetry, stories, random kitchen chatter. It's a vast archive.
So say I live in an area that's near where Rainbow Gathering might happen, like I live in a mountain town or something. What would you want me to know? Or like, what if I'm still nervous or scared about all these thousands of people showing up? What's the thing you'd want me to know?
Know that it's a temporary thing. Know that there will be care involved to make sure it is cleaned up. Like I mentioned earlier, weeks of dedication. There shouldn't be the hysteria, and I've never before seen in my nearly 30 years of gathering articles that are coming out in April. This is so early. I don't know what lit the spark, but like suddenly it was just article after article after article. A lot of them were like really like, oh, everyone had all the heebie-jeebies about it. And I was like, oh my God. And everybody in like the online, a lot of gatherers were like, what is all this? Oh my gosh. I think a local person should just know it's a one-time thing. You should feel lucky if it comes to your town because it's, and especially this year, this is the 50th year. It's the year of the Jubilee. It's 50-year anniversary of an event that's been a phenomenon that's remained outside of the realm of like the commercial world for this long.
Tenali Rennick, thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, I was glad to be here.
You just heard an excerpt from CityCast Denver, the local Denver daily news podcast. Learn more about subscribing to the podcast at denver.citycast.fm or wherever you get your podcasts.
Coming up on this afternoon's Metro Show, host Miriam Schiff speaks with Westminster-based Persian cultural arts promoter Nusheen Farjadi. She's part of a worldwide network of Persians keeping traditional Iranian music and dance alive, despite efforts within the country to prohibit these cultural expressions. These efforts include a Denver area concert this weekend by the daughter of a renowned Persian musician.
So imagine it's 1979 in Iran, it's post-revolution. The Islamists, the fundamentalists have taken over music and singing and dancing. In fact, have become sinful. So you're not supposed to do really any of them. So this is the situation. Well, Ustad Shajarian comes from a more religious family. Actually, his father was a clergyman and he was trained vastly in Iranian traditional music in Radif. And it seems he took it upon himself with Ustad Meshkatian and a couple of others to in fact save what is left of traditional Persian music and folk music.
That's coming up on this afternoon's Metro Show at 3 p.m. right here on KGNU. That's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Jack Armstrong. Shannon Young has been our producer. Special thanks to Ellie Stuckrath, Ariana Proctor, Alexis Kenyon, Miriam Schiff, Jada Rodriguez, Justin Higginbottom, and the CityCast Denver crew for their contributions to today's program. If you'd like to comment on something you heard today on KGNU, you can leave us a voicemail at 303-447-9911. We play the messages back on Tuesdays during the Morning Magazine. Stay tuned for a commentary from Jim Hightower. And then it's a public affair with KGNU's Shannon Young. That's just after these news headlines from the BBC.